Welcome to The Bitter Witness.
Don't be scared.
Hello. Welcome back. I hope you had a good week. We've had a very busy week around here. We've started our spring cleaning. So needless to say, there are piles and piles ready for our first yard sale. I know we didn't get an episode last week, and that was because I've been working on this case, and this is actually going to be our very first two-parter. If you enjoy the show, please head over to our Patreon page. For a few cents a day, you can support us and help so that we can continue to bring you wonderful true crime cases. The dogs are sleeping behind me, so today ASMR will be brought to you by both Miley and Piper's snoring. So sit back, relax, grab a cup of tea while I tell you about the case of Anna Marie Filser Hahn, the first woman to be executed by electric chair in Cincinnati, Ohio. Trigger warnings for this show includes poisoning, elder abuse, and murder. Now, let's get into the case. As always, I want to give the victims in this case top billing. However, with this case, there are many, many people who were victimized by Anna. So, to all the many victims of Anna Filser Hahn, I acknowledge you and I send my love to you wherever you may be. Anna Marie Filser Hahn was born July 7th, 1906, in the town of Füssen, located in Bavaria, Germany. Her father, George Filser, was a furniture manufacturer, and the family was considered to be well off financially. As a young girl, Anna had suffered blood poisoning, and it was thought that she was going to die. After spending 5 months in the hospital, she underwent an operation to remove her thyroid gland. At age 19, she became pregnant with her son Oscar and told her family that the father was a Viennese physician, a Dr. Max Machetki, a well-known cancer researcher. However, no record of this doctor has ever been found. To this day, the identity of Oscar's real father is still unknown. Anna's family felt scandalized by her pregnancy, so they sent her to the USA in 1929. Her son, Oscar, remained in Bavaria with her parents. She was sent to stay with relatives Max and Anna Doschel in Cincinnati, Ohio. After staying with her aunt and uncle for a time, Anna ran away. She ended up in a tiny little apartment, which was located pretty close to another distant relative of hers, a Charles Carl Oswald. Charles was a retired baker and a widower. His wife, Mary, had passed away in 1929. Anna advertised herself out as a caregiver housemaid, and she used the Doschels as a reference. Eventually, one elderly German man inquired about hiring Anna. Anna wore a silk kimono to the interview with the man, which he found rather odd. The man went to the Doschels to check out Anna's reference. While he was there, he was curious as to why Anna had left this lovely home to go live in a tiny rundown apartment. He decided not to hire Anna, which was probably one of the best decisions he had ever made in his entire life. Somehow, Anna was able to convince Charles to allow her to move in with him and take care of him, as he was 71 at the time. So Anna moved into the top floor of Charles's four-story tenement. She provided care and companionship for Charles. In exchange for the care and company that Anna gave Charles, Charles gave her stocks in various companies. Now, the two were extremely distantly related, and the relation was actually through a marriage at some point. And over time, Charles grew fond of the young, beautiful 23-year-old who was taking care of him. He asked Anna to marry him. Anna agreed to marry Charles, but on one condition, that he transfer 99 stocks of the Union Gas and Electric Company over to her. Charles agreed and transferred the stock, On top of this payment, Charles also gave Anna money whenever she needed it, which apparently was quite often. I don't know that I would want to marry someone who said they would only marry me if I transferred them stocks. I mean, really? The reason that Anna needed cash so often was because she loved betting on the horses. In fact, she loved it so much it could be and has been described as an addiction for Anna. She originally set her betting limit at $50 a day. However, that limit quickly grew and grew. And because of this growth, Anna needed to find more resources for money, especially if she was going to continue gambling at this rate. In the spring of 1929, she obtained a job as a chambermaid at the Hotel Alms. Her pay wasn't the best, but Anna never seemed to be in a state of wanting, especially since she had Charles funding her whenever she asked for anything. One thing Anna loved was going to Coney Island, and one day in the summer of 1929, she met Philip Hahn. She wasn't initially impressed by Philip's appearance. He was skinny, short, and had no muscles whatsoever. Philip struck up a conversation with Anna. However, it didn't lead to anything significant. It wasn't until the two met up again several months later at a dance for the German community that the two actually started dating. Eventually, Anna and Philip decided to get married, but Anna had already agreed to marry Charles. But Anna felt no loyalty to Charles because at that time, he had already made her sole beneficiary of his estate, around $13,000, which in today's money would be around $212,000. That's a lot of dough. On May 5th, 1930, Philip and Anna wed. The newlyweds went to her relatives, the Doschels, and announced their nuptials. Anna told her relatives that the couple would be traveling to Germany shortly to see her parents there. The true purpose of the trip was for Anna to bring Oscar back to the U.S., but Anna had never told any of her U.S. relatives about Oscar. She eventually told her relatives about Oscar, but not until they had all returned to the U.S. with him. Once the family returned to the U.S., they purchased and moved into a home. Philip worked nights for Western Union as a telegrapher, so Anna was free during the day to care for the elderly and head to the track, usually taking Oscar along with her to place her bets. Mother of the year, right here. On July 7th, Anna received 27 more shares of Union Gas from Charles. However, Charles would later deny ever giving her these stocks. She also transferred $700 from his bank account to her own and withdrew the money. At this point, Charles still had no idea that Anna had married Philip or that she had Oscar. Between January and March of 1931, Anna sold all the stocks she had received from Charles, which is most likely how she was able to afford to purchase a bakery/deli grocery store during the Great Depression. Philip quit his job at Western Union to help Anna run the business. To help enhance the family income, Anna began taking bets on the ponies while throwing together some deli sandwiches for the customers. Anna was never arrested for running the betting operation out of her store, but the police did know what she was doing and they kept a watchful eye. However, Philip and Anna's business was not immune to the Great Depression, and they soon realized they weren't doing as well as they hoped. So within a year of opening, they sold their business and purchased a deli. But that business failed too, and the couple were forced to sell it within 3 years of opening. They had also fallen behind on their mortgage payments and were in jeopardy of losing their house. During this time, Anna continued to take care of Charles, who still knew nothing about Anna's marriage or her son or what she had taken from him. That was until February 3rd, 1931, when Charles decided to update his will. He left $5 to a stepdaughter and $5 to a stepson, and then left the rest of his estate to, quote, my beloved niece, Anna Filser, unquote. About a month or so later, Charles found out about Anna's marriage and went to speak with his attorneys. In July of 1931, Charles' attorneys filed suit against Anna for breach of promise and demanded that she return all money and stocks plus 6% interest. I love these older stories because you can be sued for promising to marry someone and not doing it. The suit claimed that Anna knew that she was never going to marry Charles, and in fact knew she was going to marry someone else. Of course, Anna denied the allegations, and so the case was going to go to trial by jury. But just before the trial began, Charles's attorneys requested that the court dismiss the case without prejudice. Apparently, forgiveness was in the air. Charles died on August 14, 1935, at the age of 77. The cause of death was listed as Bright's disease and arteriosclerosis, which is a very hard word to say. But it is also damaged blood vessels caused by high blood pressure or diabetes. Anna received a check for $1,000 about a week later, as she was still the sole beneficiary. But that was all that was left in the estate. Anna had gotten everything from Charles. Just a side note here, there was never any evidence that Anna had killed Charles, only that Charles had died from natural causes. Police later looked into his death, but they didn't find anything that would indicate that Anna had initiated his death in any way. So the marriage between Philip and Anna was rocky, to say the least. The couple often argued, and according to Philip's mother, Maggie, Anna looked down her nose at any American she came in contact with. Maggie said she always had highfalutin notions. Nobody was good enough for her. I love that. Highfalutin. According to Philip's sisters, Anna would kick Philip quite often, and usually when Philip was either ill or his legs were hurting from working at the deli and then driving cab in the evenings to make ends meet for the family. Philip actually started showing signs of a mystery illness at one point. He was weak and stooped over. His mother, Maggie, spent $100 and sent Philip to a spa in Indiana, where he was able to get back on his feet. As well, according to Philip's family, his mother, Maggie, became gravely ill after Anna had given her mother-in-law a box of chocolates as a gift. Philip's sisters never put it together that both their brother and their mother may very well have been poisoned by Anna until during her trial. Then, in December of 1935, Anna tried to put a life insurance policy on Philip in the amount of $10,000, but that policy was denied. A few years later, she was able to get a $5,000 policy approved on Philip, and this caused a great amount of concern within Philip's family, but luckily the policy lapsed because Anna missed a $17 payment in July of 1937. Right before Charles died, Anna befriended another elderly German man named Ernest Kohler. Anna told the 62-year-old Ernest that he knew her father. That was her in. I guess I should say that at this time in Cincinnati, there was quite a large German population, and they all seemed to live in one certain area. Ernest owned and lived in a 3-bedroom home. Ernest lived on one floor. His son-in-law, Dr. Arnold Voss, had his office on the main floor, and Philip and Anna rented the top floor from Ernest. Dr. Voss was treating Ernest, his father-in-law, for cancer at the time that they all lived there together. Dr. Voss was notorious for forgetting to lock the door to his office, and this was a windfall for Anna. She would sneak into his office and use his phone to call her bookies and place her bets. As well, she found a prescription pad of Dr. Voss and began writing prescriptions. On April 29, 1933, Anna had two prescriptions filled, which totaled 41 morphine tablets. April 30th, 40 more tablets. May 1st, 61 tablets. May 2nd, 20 tablets. May 3rd, 21 tablets. May 4th, 21 tablets. And May 5th, 42 tablets. In 1 week, she had managed to get, add that together quickly, 146 morphine tablets. When the pharmacist asked her what was going on, she stated that she was caring for Ernest, who was battling cancer, and that she was doing so under the direction of Dr. Voss. The pharmacist was suspicious, so he wrote a letter to Dr. Voss questioning his prescribing practices, and also a letter to the federal narcotics officers. A few days later, the pharmacist received a letter from Dr. Voss stating that the prescriptions were correct. With that, the case was dropped by both the pharmacist and the narcotics agents. Little did they know that it was actually Anna who wrote the letters back, as she had intercepted the initial letter. On May 6, 1933, Anna called the authorities and informed them that her landlord, Ernest Kohler, had died, and that he had died from throat cancer. However, the police received several anonymous phone calls stating that Ernest was murdered by poisoning, so they decided to conduct an autopsy, but they found no poisons or toxins in Ernest's esophagus, so they had no choice but to label the death as being a result of throat cancer. Just like Charles, Ernest had also changed his will, leaving everything to Anna. So when Anna was given Ernest's ashes, she placed them on the mantle of her new place, which used to be Ernest's mantle. When Ernest's family found out that Anna had inherited everything from Ernest, they contested the will. Anna stated that she knew nothing about Ernest leaving her everything, and the lawsuit was settled out of court, with Anna paying Ernest's family about $4,000. She had to mortgage the home for $9,000, and the remaining $5,000 went to pay off her bookies and a few other bills. Anna was befriending more and more elderly German men in the neighborhood. She was pretty and able to speak German. Once she had gained the attention of an elderly German man, she would cry to them that she needed small amounts of cash for her to get through. For example, Walter Walther gave Anna $25 with the agreement that she would give him a check for the full amount, but he couldn't cash it until the next week. When he tried to cash it, the bank it was drawn on stated that they had no account in that name. Walter only ever received $5 back, and that was after he went to her lawyer to try and get the money. Joseph Sermon had a similar experience to Walter, only he loaned Anna $100, pretty much his entire life savings, and he never saw a penny of that money returned to him. At one point, Anna also tried her hand at fire insurance fraud. One night, there was a fire at the deli owned by her and Philip. The fire caused $300 in damage. However, that insurance check went to the owner of the building because Anna and Philip only rented the space for the deli from him. Anna and Philip sold the deli shortly after the fire. Then, on June 2, 1935, a fire broke out at Anna and Philip's home. At the time, they had a renter on the third floor, Roger Penny. Roger escaped wearing only a bedsheet and having to run through the flames to get out of the house. For that fire, Anna received just over $2,000 from the insurance company for the damages. On May 20th, 1936, another fire broke out at Anna and Philip's home. This time, Anna only received $60 for the damages. There was never a cause found for either fire, but the fire investigators kept both cases open as they both seemed suspicious. After both Charles and Ernest had passed away, Anna met George Heiss, a 63-year-old coal dealer. George had inherited his father's coal business and knew many of the Germans in the city, as he had been delivering their coal for almost 35 years. George owned a large home which he shared some of the common areas with a Margaret Tweedy, a longtime tenant whose private rooms were at the back of the house. There was no relationship between Margaret and George. They were just roommates. Anna and George spent many hours together, walking, chatting. Anna would cook German recipes for George, and George was becoming very smitten with Anna. He would refer to her as my girl. Meanwhile, Philip was rehired by Western Union and was working nights at a lower paying position than what he had had previously. So he was sleeping most of the days, which left Anna open to spend her time as she wanted, which at this point was mostly with George. Eventually, Anna informed George that she and Philip had divorced. This new information immediately had George discussing marriage between he and Anna. Anna never poo-pooed the idea of marriage, but instead milked it for everything she could. Only Anna and Philip had not divorced. And again, Anna was attempting to take George for everything she possibly could. She was continually asking George for money, and he happily handed it over to her. By the end of the summer, Anna had taken just over $2,000 from George. But the issue was that $1,200 of that money, George had actually taken from his coal company coiffeurs. Eventually, the credit manager of the coal company came after George to return the money to the company. George informed the credit manager that he had given the money to his girlfriend and that she had promised to give him in return a $7,000 trust fund that she said she had inherited, $14,000 in Union Gas and Electric stocks, and a stack of Hungarian bonds, which were currently inside a wrapped package inside his safe to keep them, well, safe. A couple of weeks after this, Anna asked George to bring the Hungarian bonds to her house and to make sure he left them inside the package because the bank manager was coming to confirm that they were genuine and he had to be the one to open the package. George, of course, complied and brought the wrapped package over to Anna's house. But after waiting for over an hour for the bank manager to appear, George decided to head home. So he left and left the package with Anna, in case the bank manager decided to show up later. Luckily for Anna, George didn't demand that she open the package, because all she had put inside it were old Hungarian losing lottery tickets that she had gotten from an acquaintance of hers. While Anna was looking after George, he began to feel ill after he would eat Anna's cooking. By the middle of October 1936, George was bedridden. He confronted Anna, who, of course, denied the poisoning allegations. However, George was convinced that Anna was trying to kill him. He told her to get out of her home and never come back. Little did George know that he had just dodged a giant, poison-filled bullet that day. The other thing that George didn't know was that while Anna was caring for him, she had gone to the druggist once asking for an ounce of oxalic acid, a strong poison usually used as a cleaning agent, and then she returned a second time asking for 25 tablets of bichloride of mercury, poison often associated with disinfectants. She was successful in obtaining the poisons both times. But then Anna tried a third time and asked the druggist for digitalis, a diuretic and a heart stimulant, but the druggist refused to sell it to her. The coal company decided to start going after Anna for the money that she had gotten from George. So Anna decided it was time to maybe start finding some different friends for a while. This time, she took aim at Mrs. Kreske, a Hungarian immigrant who was looking for work, and Stina Cable from North Carolina. The one and only time that Stina met Anna was July 15, 1936. They met in a washroom at the bus station. Anna was wearing the nurse's uniform that she often wore as she was hunting for victims. Anna offered to take Stina for a drink. Stina agreed, and the two walked over to the closest bar, where Anna bought the drinks, and began to tell Stina how she was not a nurse, but also a mind reader and a reader of palms. Stina finished her first drink and realized that something was wrong. She wasn't sure what, but something didn't feel right. Anna told Stina that a man had died drinking the same thing that Stina was drinking only a few days earlier. Suddenly, Stina's entire body was numb, and she couldn't control any of her bodily functions. Anna suggested that Stina stay with her, and Anna would nurse her back to health. But Stina insisted that she had to continue on her trip and was able to make it back to the bus station. 3 days later, on July 18th, when the bus pulled into L.A., employees had to carry Stina off the bus and took her to a hospital, where she was treated for poisoning. It took almost a full year for Stina to recover from whatever poison Anna had slipped her. Mrs. Kreske had extremely poor eyesight and was having a hard time finding a job. So when she met Anna at a casino and Anna told her that she could find her government job for the small fee of $100, Mrs. Kreske paid the fee and waited to hear her start date. When Anna came back and sheepishly informed Mrs. Kreske that she had made a mistake and the fee was actually $200, Mrs. Kreske handed over another $100 without a thought. Then another $100, and then another $200, and then her new friend Anna came to her with a receipt for the money that was borrowed. Mrs. Kreske had no problem signing the receipt that her friend put in front of her, only with her eyesight so poor, she didn't realize that she was signing a check written out to Anna for $300 on one of her own checks. But it was so nice of Anna to guide her hand to the line where she needed to sign it. But in July of 1936, Mrs. Kreske found out what Anna had done and filed a false pretense charge against Anna and demanded that the $800 be returned immediately. But when asked to sign the warrant for the arrest of Anna, Mrs. Kreske refused, stating that Anna was her good friend, and so the police had no choice but to drop the investigation. Anna must have been a smooth operator to be able to get $800 out of someone and not have them send her to jail. Once the charges against her had been dropped, Anna attended the shop of druggist Carol Deming. Anna asked for an ounce of croton oil. Carol informed Anna that what she was looking for was a very strong poison and he would have to order it in for her. Anna informed the druggist that her ex-husband, who passed away in Germany, was a druggist, and she knew how to use croton oil, so order her some. So croton oil, there's such a thing called croton oil peel. Dermatologists use it. It tightens the skin, improves the appearance of age spots, improves uneven pigmentation, and lessens wrinkles around the mouth, forehead, furrows, and crow's feet. But it can also cause irritation, dermatitis, allergic reactions. Ingestion of croton oil can lead to a burning sensation of the mouth, gastric irritation, dizziness, vomiting, and watery diarrhea with abdominal pain. Too much ingestion can lead to death. So I wonder if Anna was just going to do a peel on her face. Doubtful. The poison was ordered and arrived. Anna picked up the croton oil and told Carol that she would be in the next day to settle up her bill. But she never went back and Carol was never paid. Anna then went to Mrs. Kreske's home and began preparing a beautiful meal for her very good friend. After dinner, Mrs. Kreske fell seriously ill and was taken to the hospital. While the doctors were observing her, they noticed that the drool that was coming out of her mouth was immediately forming blisters on the skin around it. Because of this, they suspected poisoning by croton oil, but they never told the police about their suspicions. Which makes no sense. Mrs. Kreske began to recover and the doctor sent her home. But every time she would return home to the care of her very dear friend Anna, Mrs. Kreske would fall ill again and return to the hospital. A boarder that lived in the same house as Mrs. Kreske observed this pattern of his friend falling ill, returning home and then falling ill again. He became suspicious of the food and medicine that Anna was giving Mrs. Kreske, and he went to the hospital to talk with his friend. There, he found out about the $800 that Anna had taken from Mrs. Kreske. The boarder, who has never been identified, confronted Anna, who of course denied everything, so he went to Philip and to Philip's parents and demanded that they pay the money that Anna stole from his friend. When they refused to pay the $800, he informed them all that he was going to the police. The next day, Anna handed $800 to Mrs. Kreske, who was home again from the hospital. Mrs. Kreske took the money and went back home to Hungary. There, she fell ill again. This time, her legs were partially paralyzed, and she was treated for poisoning in the hospital in Hungary. I think Anna the Twat, which I have decided to call her, poisoned the bills that she gave to Mrs. Kreske. Next, Anna met Albert Palmer, known as Bertie to his family and friends. Bertie was a retired 72-year-old railway worker who loved to bet on the ponies. And the track was where Anna and Bertie met. The two formed a strong bond with their love of the ponies, and since Philip was at work during the evenings and sleeping during the day, Anna and Bertie, and of course, sometimes little Oscar, would take the streetcar to the casino and bet on horses for the day. Then they would return to Anna's home for beer and a bite to eat. Meanwhile, the credit manager from Joel's coal company was hounding her for the $1,200 she had taken from the company. Anna turned on her charm, cooing and cuddling up to Bertie, asking him for money, and like the rest of the men that Anna seduced, he more than willingly handed money over to his girl, to the tune of $2,000. Anna produced a promise to pay note, which she kept possession of, and Anna used some of the money to pay back $900 to the coal company, with a promise that she would soon get the other $300 she owned. Bertie and Anna continued to see each other on a regular basis and even planned a trip to Florida, which Bertie would tell his neighbors about with excitement. Anna began writing love letters to Bertie, scented with her perfume, and she would have Oscar deliver them for her. Some would profess her love for him, and others would ask him for money. On February 12th, Anna sent a Valentine's Day card with the following verse in it to Bertie. Quote, "The friends that we cherish as finest and true aren't always the oldest, nor are they the newest. They're the friends that have stood by when we needed them sincerely, and that's why I cherish our friendship so dearly." Unquote. She signed it, Anna and Oscar. That poem sucked. In February 1937, Bertie came to his senses and demanded that Anna pay back the money that he had given her. I think Bertie was finally putting the pieces together that every time he consumed something that Anna had made for him, he became violently ill. Bertie gave Anna an ultimatum. Either become his girlfriend permanently or repay him the money she owed him. Okay, wait, maybe he wasn't putting all the pieces together completely. Or maybe his pieces formed a different picture. But Anna couldn't and wouldn't do either. Anna was now getting frantic, not knowing what she was going to do. Then her fortune seemed to change on March 26, 1937, when Bertie died of an apparent heart attack brought on by the flu. Poor Bertie died penniless. His life savings of about $5,000 was all but gone. On March 29, 1937, 3 days after Bertie died, Anna applied to the Hazelmeyer Employment Bureau for a position as a practical nurse or companion. Her application stated that she was a widow with experience and that compensation wasn't important. Anna didn't have any luck with the employment agency, but unfortunately, she did have luck by simply knocking on some of the doors in the German neighborhood. This girl has chutzpah. This is when she knocked on the door of Jacob Wagner, a 78-year-old widower. Jacob had come to the U.S. in 1885 and settled in Cincinnati. He was a gardener and had cared for many gardens of prominent families in the area. On May 13, 1937, a neighbor of Jacob's, Elizabeth Colby, had just returned from work and was preparing dinner when there was a knock on her door. When she opened it, there stood a beautiful blonde woman who, when she spoke, was obviously German. The woman entered into Elizabeth's apartment without an invite and swept through as though looking for something. The woman asked Elizabeth if any old men lived in the building. Elizabeth, taken aback a little by the brashness of the woman, said, "What do you mean, old men? There are several that live in this building. Why, there's one who just lives down the hall there." The woman was Anna, and the old man down the hall was Jacob. Anna told Elizabeth that she had already knocked on that door and no one answered. Elizabeth said, "Well, Mr. Wagner must be out then." Anna stopped short. "Wagner is the name? Well, I am Mr. Wagner's niece, and I have a letter from family in Baden-Baden, Germany, about a family inheritance." Elizabeth thought this all sounded strange and became immediately suspicious of Anna. Anna asked to borrow a pen and paper. She proceeded to write a note and slip it under Jacob's door. She informed Elizabeth that she would return in a few days. Anna returned, but there was still no answer at Jacob's door, so she slipped another note under it. When Elizabeth saw Jacob next, she told him about the strange woman and the visit and what Anna had told her. Jacob replied, I don't know anyone like that. There must be some mistake." But within a few days, Jacob and Anna had met and began spending time together. He would go to her house and she would come to his. Jacob even began telling neighbors that he had a new girl. 2 weeks and 2 days after Anna had barged her way into Elizabeth's apartment, Jacob entered his bank and told the bank manager that a woman, a school teacher, had stolen his bank book when he had left his apartment to fetch a pail of beer. The bank book that was taken showed that Jacob had more than $4,000 in his account, and it had been under his mattress. Then Jacob produced two bank books that Anna had given him. The first was a foreign bank book and showed no balance, but the second was a local bank book and it showed that there was a balance of $3. The $3 balance was obviously printed by bank machine, but also inside this bank book were typewritten entries. These entries showed that the account had more than $15,000 in it. The bank manager told Jacob that the latter entries were definitely forgeries. He then told Jacob to bring the bank books back to the bank after the holiday weekend, as it was Memorial Day, which at the time was called Decoration Day, and once the weekend was over, the bank manager would look into prosecuting Anna. So what was happening here was sort of like a bait and switch. Anna would take Jacob's bank book, which would give her access to the account, and in turn she would leave her doctored bank books with him as security, because her bank books showed that she had over $15,000 in her account, but her account was actually at zero. She had even taken the $3 out, which had been deposited for Oscar. Jacob left the bank and started to walk home. He ran into an old friend of his, Joe. The two exchanged pleasantries, and Joe offered Jacob one of his canes jokingly, referring to how the two men had aged. Jacob told his friend about the bank books and how upset he was about the whole thing. Then Jacob stopped at the local drinking hole and joined two different friends of his, Otto and Frank. He had just told the men about the bank books when Anna walked into the bar. Jacob jumped up and cornered Anna, accusing her of taking his bank book. Anna, now humiliated in public, became indignant and said she had done no such thing. Jacob couldn't blame her when he obviously just misplaced his bank book. Anna also said, "Where are my bank books? I want them back now." Jacob told her that her bank books were gone. They weren't, but that's what he told her. Anna suggested that the two of them go back to his apartment and look for his bank book. Jacob agreed, but before he left the bar, he quietly slipped Anna's two bank books to Frank. Jacob whispered, "Hang on to these until I get back." Jacob and Anna returned within 10 minutes, as Anna had found Jacob's bank book. So Jacob gave her back her two bank books. Then Anna phoned the bank manager to inform him that the bank book had been found and that all was well. Now, remember Elizabeth, the neighbor of Jacob, who Anna knocked on her door asking about older men? Well, Elizabeth was actually in the process of moving when Anna knocked on her door. Elizabeth was moving with her adult daughter, Josephine Martin, to a bigger apartment, which just happened to be across the alley from the building where she was currently living. And in her new apartment, she could actually see right into Jacob's apartment through the windows. The day after the bank books were found, Elizabeth was in her new apartment, probably unpacking, and happened to look out the window and saw Anna sitting in a rocking chair inside Jacob's bedroom. She saw Anna get up and pass a glass of what looked like juice to Jacob. Elizabeth called Josephine to come and look at the spectacle. You see, Elizabeth didn't think it was proper for a young woman such as Anna to be inside Jacob's apartment, let alone in his bedroom. Josephine came over and looked out the window, but she thought her mother was being a little old-fashioned about the whole thing. Meanwhile, over in Jacob's apartment, Jacob was in excruciating pain. He was not well at all. And under the guise of tending to him, Anna was there giving him juice and trying to make him comfortable, but in reality, she was doing anything but. Jacob was due back at the bank on the Tuesday morning with all the bank books so that the bank manager could investigate further and possibly prosecute Anna. But instead, Anna walked into the bank with a note for the bank manager. The note was full of spelling mistakes, and Anna informed the bank manager that it was in fact a note from Jacob. She had been asked to deliver it as Jacob was under the weather. The note read, quote, "I am very sorry what happened. Saturday, nith my book. I found unter a paper on the self. It all was a mistake, and I don't want my niece, Mrs. Hahn, to be accused of anything. I been sick since Saturday evening and leave it up to Mrs. Hahn to straighten this matter out. Signed, Jacob Wagner." Unquote. When Anna returned to Jacob in his apartment, he had attempted to get out of bed, but he could no longer walk, and he fell and gave himself a nasty gash across his forehead. Finally, on Wednesday, Anna called for a doctor to come and look at Jacob. When Dr. Marnell saw Jacob, he thought that Jacob was chronically ill and instructed Anna to call an ambulance. Anna rode with Jacob in the ambulance to Good Samaritan Hospital. They arrived at 3:30 p.m. Admitting clerk Laura Bohm watched as Anna signed Jacob into the hospital. Anna told Laura, "Get him the best room in the hospital and the best care. He has lots of money." Anna wrote on the admittance slip that she was Jacob's niece and that she would be responsible for the hospital charges. Then Anna told Laura how worn out she was from caring for her uncle for the last week. Anna said, "You know how it is with relatives. They never know you, only when they need you." Yeah, Jacob needed Anna like a hole in the head. At 8 p.m., Dr. Marnell stopped in to check on his patient. He described Jacob as semi-conscious, retching with pain, and in a state of shock and dying. Elizabeth Morabeck, a nurse who had been on the front lines of World War I, checked in on her charge later in the evening. Her description of Jacob was gut-wrenching. She stated that Jacob was a terrifying image of a man in agony. There were tears streaming down his cheeks. He was sweating profusely. She stated that his fists were clenched so tightly he couldn't ring for help. He was writhing in pain and begging for water. She said he was barely able to get the words out in German, "I could drink a barrel of water." Jacob passed away just past midnight on June 3rd. When Anna returned to the hospital at 8 a.m., she refused to sign for an autopsy and informed the hospital staff that she actually barely knew Jacob, that she had merely helped the other tenants of the building to break down his door and ensure that he got to the hospital, that, in fact, Jacob was not her uncle. She was just a good neighbor. Dr. Marnell refused to sign a death certificate because he wasn't sure what the cause of death was, which is why the hospital wanted an autopsy. Another doctor in the hospital informed Anna that if she didn't sign for the autopsy, Jacob's death would be handed over for investigation to the county coroner, and since Anna wanted no part of that, she signed for the autopsy. Once Anna had signed for the autopsy for Jacob, she headed straight for Jacob's bank. She handed the bank manager a note written in pencil that instructed the bank to give Anna a $1,000 check. The bank manager refused to honor the note, so Anna produced a withdrawal slip for $1,000 signed by Jacob, but again the bank manager refused to honor that slip as well, as it too was signed in pencil. Instead, he gave her a new withdrawal slip, properly filled out in ink, and told Anna to take it to Jacob at Deaconess Hospital and have him sign it. Anna had told the bank manager that Jacob was at Deaconess and he was very ill. Anna left and returned 2 hours later with the withdrawal slip signed by Jacob in ink. But while Anna was gone, the bank manager called Deaconess Hospital, only to find out that there was no patient there named Jacob Wagner. He confronted Anna about the lie. Anna broke into her now well-perfected sobbing performance. She stated that she had made a silly mistake, that Jacob was actually at Good Samaritan Hospital, but here is another note from Jacob instructing you to let me have control over his bank account. When the bank manager called Good Samaritan Hospital, you can imagine his surprise when he was informed that Jacob had died during the night. He again confronted Anna, who perhaps pulled one of the best performances of her life out of her ass. She sobbed that she had signed Jacob's name because he wanted her to pay his expenses, and just how awful would it be if her son were to grow up without his mother, all because she had tried to do the right thing and help Jacob while he was sick and dying, and please don't call the police. The bank manager bought it. Damn those woman tears. Anna had dodged a bullet. She left the bank without the money, but at least she wasn't going to jail. When Anna got home, she quickly set to writing out Jacob's last will and testament. It read, "I hereby make my last will and testament, and I am under no influence. I have my money in the Fifth Third Bank. After my funeral expenses and all bills are paid, I want the rest to go to my relative, Anna Hahn. I want Mrs. Hahn to be my executor. I don't want any flowers, and I don't want to be laid out." This bitch is unbelievable. She gets away with forgery and theft at the bank with the bank manager, but she doesn't stop. She just decides to forge his will. And then she writes in the will that he doesn't want a funeral and no flowers. Like, what? Oh, she's unreal. Anna took the will and returned to Jacob's apartment. There she ran into Anna Eberhardt and Anna Decker, two elderly neighbors who also lived in Jacob's building and were friends with Jacob. Neither of the women could read English, but Anna asked them both in German to sign the document that she was holding in front of them, which of course was written in English. Anna very sweetly told them that the papers were simply admittance papers for another of their neighbors to hospital, one Mrs. Olive Kohler. She needed to receive some treatment, and Anna needed two signatures to make that happen. The document, of course, was Jacob's will that Anna had just written. The ink probably wasn't even dry yet. You see, Anna needed two signatures of witnesses for the will to be valid. The two women refused to sign the papers and suggested to Anna that it might be better if Olive's sister, Mary Arnold, signed the papers. Not giving up yet, that afternoon, a probate officer met Anna at Jacob's apartment. The goal of the visit was to find the will of the late Jacob Wagner. Together with Anna, the two searched the apartment until the will was found under a newspaper on the mantel. When the probate officer looked at the will, he saw that there were no witness signatures on it, which meant that the will was not valid. But Anna turned on the charm, and the probate officer took the will with him. Only three people attended Jacob's funeral: Anna Eberhardt, Anna Decker, and Anna Hahn. Of course, our Anna was sobbing tears, and as she left the cemetery after the service, she said to the two ladies, "This is the second uncle I have buried this month." Olive Kohler was a 79-year-old widower who also lived in the same building as the two Annas and Jacob. One afternoon, there was a knock on her door, and there stood Anna Hahn, dressed in a Salvation Army uniform, informing Olive that it was her job to take care for the elderly who were infirm. Olive thought this was wonderful, a German-speaking young woman to come in and keep her company. On June 22nd and 23rd, Anna brought ice cream for both Olive and her sister Mary to help combat the heat of the summer. As soon as Olive ate the ice cream, she became violently ill. Luckily, Mary only had a small bite of the ice cream the first time and didn't feel well for a short spell, but the second time, she didn't eat any of it. Mary, Olive's sister, lived in a building close by her sister's building. Mary's apartment was above a grocery store run by Mathilde Profiter. This store is where Anna bought the ice cream for Olive and Mary. Mathilde didn't like Anna from the start. On June 24th, Anna came into the store, and Mathilde informed her that Olive was very sick, to which Anna answered, "Well, she lived her life." Well, that pretty much set Mathilde into attack mode. Mathilde called the Salvation Army and found out that there was no one by the name of Anna Hahn assigned to take care of elderly people. In fact, there was no one in their organization named Anna Hahn, period. The next day, Mathilde found Anna outside of Mary's door with a big brimmed straw hat hiding her face. Now, Mary was 95 years old and her eyesight was failing her. This time, Anna told Mary that she was actually Lillian, an old friend of Mary's. So, Mary, excited to see her dear friend Lillian, let Anna come in, and Anna began to pretend she was tidying up her old friend's apartment to help her, but in fact, Anna was searching for whatever she could find. She found $200 under Mary's mattress, which she pocketed. Anna then offered to go clothes shopping for Mary, and Mary was just about to write a blank check for Anna when Mathilde opened the door and confronted Anna. Mathilde told her to stop deceiving the old people, to which Anna replied, "What does it matter who they think I am as long as they are happy? I love them, and I'm just trying to help." Mathilde basically told Anna to fuck off and trip on her way out the door, to which Anna stated that she ran a big hospital and she had a good reputation for taking care of people. Of course, Mathilde checked on this claim and again found out that no one named Anna Hahn worked for the hospital that Anna claimed to run. Mathilde called the police to report Anna for what she was doing, but the police didn't really pay attention to the complaint and chalked it up to a dispute between neighbors. On July 6th, the body of 67-year-old George Selman was discovered by a neighbor. George was described as a ladies' man. In fact, he had proposed marriage to a woman a few months before his death, but she had rejected his offer. When she saw him a few days later on the street, he grabbed her arm and said, "You wouldn't marry me, so I found a young, pretty German school teacher who will marry me. We're getting married on July 7th, and then we're going to live in the sun in California." Of course, the woman he thought was a school teacher was Anna Hahn. The day after George Selman's body was discovered, Anna Hahn was arrested, but not for murder, for a bounced $10 check to a department store. She paid the $10 immediately with some cash that she had actually gotten from Selman and was freed to continue on in her deadly rampage. Anna's next target was Johann Obendorfer, a 67-year-old widower and a cobbler with a little shoe shop. In June, Anna entered into his shop and the two became fast friends. But as July arrived, Anna found herself exceptionally busy. She was courting Johann, where the conversations had started to turn to discussions of marriage, as well she was still poisoning Olive and George Selman. On July 10th, Olive was admitted to Longview State Hospital for the insane. I guess the poisonings had finally broken Olive. On July 6th, George Selman's body was discovered. Johan and Anna had decided and planned a trip to Colorado Springs. The trip was to go and stay at Anna's $18,000 cattle ranch, which of course she didn't own. On July 16th, the couple visited Johan's bank, where he withdrew $350 to pay for his train ticket to Colorado and any little incidentals that they may need on the trip. He gave the money to Anna, she deposited $250 into her bank account, and probably spent the other $100 on the horses. On July 20th, Johan packed a wicker satchel and headed out for the trip with his sweetheart, or Liebchen, as he called her to all his friends and family. He stopped for a beer at Albert Schell's restaurant and then went over to his Liebchen's home, where he spent the night so he could rise early and set out on their trip. That night, Anna made Johan a special dinner to celebrate the trip. By the next morning, Johan needed help getting into the cab. Depot was the only word Anna said as she and Oscar loaded Johan into the cab. Once at the station, Anna bought some sandwiches for Oscar and Johan and left the two on a bench, telling them she had an errand to run downtown before they boarded their train to Colorado. But Anna actually went home and left a note for her husband Philip saying that she and Oscar had gone to Colorado for a few days. She returned to the station and the trio made the first leg of the journey to Chicago. Once in Chicago, Anna checked Johan into a 25-cent a night flop house, and then she and Oscar checked into the Stevens Hotel. At $8 a night, it was the largest hotel on Michigan Avenue. Of course that's where she went. The next morning, Anna collected Johan from his flop house. On July 23rd, the three arrived at Denver's train station. They walked to the Oxford Hotel, where Anna secured a room for her and Oscar for $1.50 a night, and a single room for Johan for $1 a night. But a hotel porter noticed Johan writhing in pain on his bed when he stuck his head into Johan's room, as the door had been accidentally left open. When the porter mentioned something to Anna about how sick Johan appeared, she checked them all out and moved to the Midland Hotel. But the staff there also noticed how sick Johan was and said something to their chief clerk, George Matthews. When Matthews approached Anna and inquired about Johan's condition, Anna replied, "Oh, he'll be all right in a few days. I just fed him a good dose of croton oil." She also fed him watermelon, which at the time was considered a good rat poison. Wait, what? Watermelon is a rat poison? So actually, the black seeds in watermelon contain trace amounts of cyanide, but they are harmless unless you eat a large quantity of them. For every 100 grams of black seeds, there's about 0.79 milligrams of cyanide. However, there are also several minerals and nutrients found in the black seeds of watermelon, like folate, iron, zinc, copper, magnesium, and potassium. Apparently, people roast them and eat them like sunflower seeds. The things you learn when you have a podcast. So my guess would be that because the rats can't throw up, people thought that the cyanide in the seeds of watermelon would kill the rats. Anna sat down in Midland Hotel and penned a letter back to Johan's bank. It read, "Dear Mr. Becker, enclosed you find Mr. Johan Obendorfer's passbook. I advised him to the Denver National Bank. They will take care of him. I am leaving for Newcastle tomorrow to take care of my own business matters. Then I will return to Cincinnati by Saturday or Sunday. Mr. Obendorfer is going to stay in Colorado with his sister-in-law or whatever relative she is to him. He also has quite a number of friends here from the old country, and he'll enjoy life more than he ever did before. He was thinking of buying a little chicken farm. He has one in mind. If he can get the right price for it, he'll take it. Mr. Obendorfer wants the building and loan to send him a $1,000 check and send it to the Denver National Bank, where he is going to deposit the money. He would like to have it as soon as possible in case he would find a nice place so he could take it right away. As soon as I return to Cincinnati, I'll stop in and see you about some property. Signed, A. Felser." The letter was dated July 24th. That Saturday, Anna went to the Denver National Bank and posed as Mrs. Obendorfer. She asked the bank to transfer $1,000 from Johann's account in Cincinnati to an account there. The bank manager asked her to bring in Johann as it was his account, not hers. Anna told the bank manager that Johann was out of town visiting relatives. Anna left the bank and returned on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday that week. And each time she turned up, the transfer still hadn't happened, and she got more and more angrier. Meanwhile, back at the hotel, Johann could no longer control any of his bodily functions, and he was left writhing in pain on his bed. One day, when Anna and Oscar returned from the bank, the chief clerk, George Matthews, asked Anna about the old man and informed her that the housekeeping staff refused to enter the room because of the stench. Anna informed Matthews that she didn't know who the old man was, just that she had met him on the train and, because he appeared ill, she began to take care of him. She told Matthews that if he got her some clean sheets, she would change the bed. The next day, Matthews decided to take a look at the old man for himself, and when Anna and Oscar left for the bank, he went up to Johann's room and opened the door. He found the room completely saturated with vomit and feces, and Johann was sitting in a chair, bent into the fetal position, and writhing back and forth in pain. When Anna and Oscar returned to the hotel, Matthews confronted her and told her the man needs a doctor. Anna responded with, "Oh, I don't think it's that serious, is it?" Matthews told Anna that yes, it was, and that she had to take him to a hospital. Anna told Matthews that the old man had no money, and neither did she, so she couldn't take him to a hospital. Matthews then offered to pull a few strings and try and get Johann into a charity hospital, to which Anna responded, "Well, I don't know. I promised his people in Cincinnati that I would make sure he got to Colorado Springs," which, if she had stopped to think about it, that statement totally contradicted the statement that she had told Matthews the day before. That night, Anna, Oscar, and Johann were on a train to Colorado Springs and away from the nosy chief clerk, Matthews. If Anna had waited only one more day in Chicago, she would have had the $1,000 transfer from Cincinnati into Johann's account. Once in Colorado Springs, Anna checked the trio into the Park Hotel, which was run by Pell and Rosie Turner. While staying at the Park Hotel, Anna was leaving Johann's room and noticed a door open in the hallway. Anna slipped into the room and snatched two diamond rings that she spied on the dresser. As she was turning and about to leave the room, Anna was blocked by Rosie Turner. "These are private quarters," Rosie stated. Anna quickly responded with, "Oh, I was just curious as to what they looked like." With that, Anna swept by Rosie and continued on her day. Rosie didn't notice at that time that her rings were missing. But the theft of those two rings were the actual event that sealed Anna's date with the electric chair. After sightseeing with Oscar around Colorado Springs for a few days, eventually Anna had to concede at how bad of shape Johann was in, and she took Johann to Bethel Hospital and checked him in as an indigent. Johann died on August 1st at 6:30 p.m., the same day that, back in Cincinnati, Jacob Wagner's body was being exhumed. The hospital reached out to Anna to inform her that Johann had passed away, to which her response was, "Why notify me? I don't know him. I met him on the train between Denver and Colorado Springs, and I got to talking with him because I am Swiss and he is Swiss, and we were both from Cincinnati." The same day, two Colorado Springs detectives had visited Pell Turner at the Park Hotel, asking about Johann and his traveling companions. When Pell saw Anna that evening in the lobby at 7:30, he asked her if she had heard about Johann's passing. Anna again stated quite flippantly that she had only met him by chance on the train and she didn't really know him at all. The next day, Anna and Oscar boarded the train to Denver, but before doing so, she opened Johann's wicker satchel and found the two salt shakers inside. One empty and the other contained 82% arsenic trioxide, which she had placed there. She then threw away the satchel and the salt shakers and boarded the train with her son. In Denver, she checked into the same hotel as before, the Midland. Upon arrival, she was asked how Johann was doing, and she answered, "Oh, he's getting along quite nicely in Colorado Springs. Thank you for asking." The next day, she pawned Rosie Turner's two diamond rings and received $7.50 for them. She instructed Oscar that if anyone ever asks you where we got those rings, you say you found them on the street. Oscar nodded to his mother. She pawned the rings under the name Marie Fisher from the Steffens Hotel, Chicago. The Steffens Hotel was where she had stayed 13 days earlier, and she spelled Chicago wrong. Oscar and Anna took the Burlington Zephyr back to Cincinnati and arrived there on August 9th. Since she really didn't get a financial windfall from Johann, she started looking for another mark. She was scanning the papers when she saw an ad for Female Help Wanted. The ad stated that a white woman about 30 was needed to care for an elderly gentleman for $10 a week. But before she could apply for the job, there was a knock on her door. It was the police. And that is where I'm going to leave you for today. We'll pick up tomorrow with the rest of the case of Anna Felser Hahn. This has been a Bitter Witness production.